Olivier Clément's book, The Roots of Christian Mysticism, and the publishing information for this book is found in the course syllabus for those who may wish to purchase it for themselves. Olivier Clément's approach is very much the same as the approach that we are using in this course. He bases himself on primary texts drawn from the patristic and early monastic period, and in so doing tries to recover models of spiritual progress and approaches to the understanding of the interrelationship between ascetical and mystical theology that come largely from the early church and not solely or exclusively from the later scholastic period. In this, he differs in his approach from the more modern textbooks of ascetical mystical theology, such as Tanquiri and Jordan Aumann, which are, of course, very valuable and useful. But at the same time, I believe Clément is recovering a tradition that is well worth our attention and which does not attempt to be as precise as some of the later post-scholastic approaches do in matters about which precision is perhaps less possible than was once thought. This chapter, The Interior Combat, is the second chapter of part two of his book, The Roots of Christian Mysticism. Part two is entitled Initiation for Warfare, and this chapter obviously is on the interior combat, on asceticism as the struggle to overcome vice and the passions, that is to say, the things that render us unfree, the things that we would today characterize as addictive or compulsive, and the quest for virtue. This is the traditional division of the ascetic life, as we have already seen in a number of sources. But I'd like to look at it from the perspective that Clément presents, in that it will remind us of many of the themes we've seen, anticipate quite a few themes we will be discussing in much more detail in terms of individual passions or vices, and highlight important themes in regard to the spiritual and ascetical tradition, which we should constantly be alert to, from the perspective of very important fundamental texts in the tradition. He approaches the matter in a way which we will look at in just a moment, and I want to highlight, however, that on these web pages, the subdivisions that I have created in the dark-colored blue bars, and which you can get to by clicking from the very top of the page on any of these subsections, these are my own artificial divisions of this chapter and are not found in Clément's book. It enables me to refer more easily to different portions of the book, but again, it represents an artificially imposed subdivision of the chapter and should not be taken too literally. He begins by raising the very important question of restoring the divine image. And this provides us with a kind of an anthropological and theological background for asceticism, which is vitally important. And that is that all has not been lost through the fall, that we still possess the divine image within our hearts, and that a very important part of the spiritual task is to allow this image to be restored by Christ and through our cooperation with Christ. And the language he uses in this first chapter is a challenge to us because in the tradition, the discipline of ascetical theology has very often been characterized as always running the danger of Pelagianism, of imagining that we are responsible for our own spiritual improvement and ultimately for our own salvation, which is of course false. But asceticism does run that risk, and it's important to confront that risk head on. Ascesis, as he points out and as we've seen in so many different sources, refers to exercise or combat. He points out, Clément points out, that we are creators. God has enabled us to create and even to transform. And we'll see this as an important theme in his chapter on natural contemplation, beholding God in creation, that our capacity to create, our capacity to transform, is an exercise of the royal priesthood. This is a means by which we are God's instruments for the conversion and the transformation, above all else, of our own hearts. Christ invites us to convert, we cooperate with that process, and then Christ makes us into instruments for transformation, conversion of the world around us. It's important to always remember, as we find highlighted, that it is transformation in Christ. We find particularly in the third paragraph that it is the Word who can restore, it is the Word who acts, But we have this obligation to cooperate with him. Now, many of the churches of the Reformation shudder at this kind of language. Any language of cooperation seems to them to be dangerous, to verge on a notion of works righteousness. And it is important to reflect on these questions and to come to one's own conclusions. But simply to back away from them will mean that one has no doctrine of spiritual progress or of sanctification. Ultimately, of course, it is always Christ's work in us, but it is a work that God ennobles and enables us to experience a dignity in that he makes us cooperators with. He makes us cooperators with his grace in a process of change. And it is not our own doing exclusively, but at the same time, we do contribute by cooperating. We must participate in what God has begun to do within us. And he emphasizes that the principal thing is, as we see, to allow God to recreate this image that has been, and the various metaphors that are used, this image has been tarnished, it has been darkened, but of course it has never been fully lost. We are not completely transformed into the opposite of what we were made for. In this great long text from Origen's commentary, a homily on Genesis, the conclusion is the image of God remains in you always. And indeed, the corollary of this, or the conclusion, is in the next paragraph, ascesis involves freeing human nature to follow its deep instinct to ascend towards God. And he uses models of the heart, which is enlarged, taken from the rule of Saint Benedict in the paragraph that follows after that, and then speaks of ascesis as a response of love. We are to respond to the God who in love invites us to participate in a process of purification. If we drop down now to the blue bar that I've labeled number 2, 3 modes of spiritual progress, he presents the classical three steps, sometimes called the three stages of praxis or practice, then contemplation of nature, beholding God in creation, which we will study in more detail in the next chapter we will look at from his book, and then a notion of a progress into union with God. The danger, of course, in this language or in these models, as we've already seen, is regarding them as a stepwise progression rather than as, if you will, primary colors or notes in a chord, themes that are always present in the spiritual life. If we drop down then to number 3, he presents the model which we will be looking at in detail of the tripartite soul. That is to say, the innermost self that consists of nous, where the image of God is most truly experienced, a place which is capable of contemplation, and where the light of God's presence is most fully known, which is also the place of insight and spiritual wisdom, which is also bound together with our great capacity for a kind of heroic courage called thumos and epithumia, our ability to desire, to be drawn towards the beautiful. And all of these things are capable of leading us towards God or of being transformed into their opposites, becoming what we would today call addictions or compulsions, which in the ancient tradition were called passions, things that render us passive. And this invites a study of virtue and vice, a division according to this tripartite model of the different levels of the self. And I wanted to highlight his, if you drop down a little bit further, emphasis on the three great vices of forgetfulness, spiritual insensitivity, or anesthesia, as it's literally called in Greek, and ignorance, an unwillingness to see the truth, or a developing incapacity to this, not having anything to do with one's natural capacity for intellectual work, but rather a deliberate refusal to see the truth of what God has presented before us. If we drop down a little further to number 4, he emphasizes the transforming power of asceticism. And in this section, he's primarily pointing out that the goal is to take all of these energies, all of these capacities, and allow them to be a means by which God transforms and heals first that which is within us, and then enables us to become the instruments for the transformation and healing of all that is around us, as we'll see in the next chapter on the contemplation of God in creation. The monk, that is to say the ascetic, becomes at the end of this section, just before section number 5 on the blue bar, a center of blessing. We discover ourselves capable of reaching out in blessing to bestow on others and on the world around us that blessing which Christ shows to us in our own healing and purification. The section number 5, I'm not going to look at in much detail. He reminds us that it is traditionally couched in the language of the commandments that ascetical practice is described, but not just the 10 commandments. Very often, or more often, understood as the as an explication of the Beatitudes or the Sermon on the Mount, and he gives examples of the transformation of these commandments borrowed from the rule of Saint Benedict and the writings of Dieticus of Photiki, and a section also from Maximus Confessor. He emphasizes in section 6 a kind of gathering together of ascetical endeavor under the category or rubric of fasting. At its most fundamental level, a willingness to make choices about the things we eat or the things we enjoy, not because these things are bad in any sense, but because we can grow then in our capacity to choose what is good for us. And we'll study this in more detail when we look particularly at fasting in the context of gluttony. But fasting, he says here, is an opportunity for changing from an attitude of the world that seeks to possess to an attitude toward the world that instead wants to cherish, to allow the self to experience the healing grace that is in creation. For him is a long section, because for him fasting is a way of talking more generally about this experience of transformation that takes place when we acquire a new relationship with that world of which we are a part, not seeking to possess, dominate, or to allow ourselves to be dominated by, but instead entering into a freely chosen relationship of cherishing and indeed of spiritual transformation. In section 7, he talks about charity, the great commandment of love, and the transformation of, in effect, all the passions into the charity that is most fully seen in Christ. And then in section 8, a section we won't have a chance to look at in as much detail as it warrants, but which you certainly will have the opportunity to look at now, the necessity of having a spiritual guide, of having someone who can help us in this process of spiritual growth and change. And he lists 6 characteristics. Number 1, that the spiritual guide knows the path from their own experience. Number 2, that this individual can sometimes simply be a silent witness to this spiritual path, may not necessarily be offering great insight, but simply is a reminder of the possibility of committing ourselves to this project, and that in itself can be of value. Related to this, number 3, very important, especially in the Eastern tradition, the spiritual guide as one who prays, as one who is lifting up the other in prayer, in intercession, and in a very real sense, as someone who is a means by which the other is lifted to God, a living representative of the communion of saints. 8.4, a reminder that especially in the Eastern tradition, the spiritual guide can sometimes be someone who has this flash of insight or who represents for us the possibility of a sudden and unexpected sense of what is traditionally called the anagogical, the heavenly, almost the eschatological presence of God in our midst, a reminder of the truth of heaven that constantly surrounds us, which may be done even without words. And in the 5th characteristic in this section 8, the spiritual guide is one who manifests great compassion, great love, and number 6, that this is someone of wisdom, someone of real discernment. Well, these are a lot of themes, and my principal goal in inviting us to take a look at this text is to introduce what we will be studying in more detail in subsequent sections of the course, but also to provide us in this section of this chapter an opportunity to go back and to meditate on, to reflect on these texts that highlight these very important themes, and also perhaps to whet your appetite for Clément's book, which I strongly recommend and which you may well find useful in continuing to study on your own the themes we're considering in this course.